I've known this guy for a little while here. He and I, we at one point in time had a mutual best friend. And he decided that he wanted to go out to do some research, and I think today he's in the big meeting in the sky. He better be in the big meeting in the sky. He better be going to some meetings in the sky. Anyway, this guy, Charlie, I've always admired his sobriety. One of his sayings, when you're out having a good time with little Charlie, he'll say, "Boy, we're living the promises now." I met him like a year or two sober, and I was like, "Huh?"
He'll get you.
Anyway, he's a good egg. He's great. Love sobriety. I just love people that love sobriety. And for further ado, let's give him a big River Bend welcome. Wow.
Hi everybody, I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and for that I'm truly grateful and sometimes astounded. It's funny, I can't believe I've never been to this meeting before. I've been hearing about this meeting for a long time, but And I kind of knew which building it was in, but I just never had quite the guts to come out here and look around. But I'm glad to be here. I've got three regular meetings that I go to every week, and it's good to get out. It's a great-looking bunch, and I want to thank the people that asked me to come talk tonight. It's funny, I had to start writing down some notes on my talk, which is, I always thought that was the Al-Anons that did that. But a buddy of mine and I were talking the other day, and at the same time, he was speaking in Dallas, and I was speaking in Austin at another fellowship, and he called me later. Both of us are big, love the big book, and like to talk about it and stuff, and he called me and goes, "How'd your talk go?" I said, "Oh, Tom, I did it again." He said, "What?" I said, "I looked up 37 minutes into the talk, and I was still drinking whiskey." And he goes, "That's all right. Two-thirds of the way into my talk, I was 14. Our book says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's what I always try to do when I talk, and that's what I try to go back to if I ever get nervous. Just to talk a little bit about what it was like, I came from a good family. I was the only drunk, still the only drunk in my family, and I did have a sister that was perfect, and that was a little tough to go through, but my mother was a first grade teacher for 42 years, and let's just say I was well prepared for the first grade. So I looked pretty good, when I got up there. Hi, Dave. I was well prepared for the first grade, and I got in there, and so they kept talking about my potential. I used to test well, and they would talk about my potential, and you're not living up to your potential. And I don't know if anybody else has suffered under the burden of potential, but one thing I can report to you is that 12 or 15 years of drinking whiskey and shooting dope will significantly lower people's expectations of you. By the time I got to this program, it was like, just get a job, we don't care about an education anymore or a career, just get off the couch, for God's sake. But, it's funny, I started drinking, I had my first drink, and then there's two episodes that I remember, and they were both in the ninth grade, and, so I started drinking in the ninth grade, and it seemed young at the time, but nowadays that makes me kind of a late bloomer. People are sobering up at like 8 now. I thought I was getting early. This buddy of mine, PJ, is 38 and has been sober 24 years. And And if you listen to his story, he didn't get here any too early either. You know, I mean, he was he had a pretty good run at it. But I just, you know, I started, for my story, I started at 16. And it was fairly insignificant and then a hugely significant event at the same time. I mean, I don't have to tell you what it was like when I... If you're alcoholic in this room, if you're non-alcoholic in this room, I welcome you. And if you are, I don't need to tell you what that first drink was like. But it was a big day for me. And it'd be impressive to stand up here and say that I got smashed every day for the rest of my until I got here. But that wouldn't be true because I didn't get loaded every day. But the thing I can tell you, in all honesty, is that from that day until the day I had to stop, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded for any reason, under any circumstances. There was never a time that somebody would offer it up and I'd say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, it's my mother's birthday, or I have an engagement, or, you know, I need to be somewhere in November, or, you know, or something. It was just, all bets were off at any opportunity. And I did that for a long time. And, you know, it's funny, when we got here, I say that I'm an alcoholic. Before I go any further, I hope I don't offend anybody if I mention any outside issues, but my problem was alcoholism. My problem was alcoholism from elementary school. And my biggest problem was a spiritual malady. But I didn't know what that was in junior high school. You know, and what showed up for me was alcoholism. My alcoholism led me to do a lot of things other than drink alcohol. I still have alcoholism show up from time to time in my sober life. But in fact, it's funny, when you get here... I don't know, for anybody that's new, I welcome you, but, you know, it's like we're speaking a different language in here. You know, you walk in, and it's Mr. Bill and Dr. Bob and step this and step that and this promise and that tradition, and you start hearing terms you never heard. One of them I never heard when I got here was somebody talks about their drug of choice. And I thought that was so cute, you know. I mean, did anybody talk about that when we were out there? I mean, do you ever remember anybody coming up to you going, I'm sorry, no, that's not my particular drug of choice. I mean, for me, it was like I had stuff that I would spend my money on. But whatever you've got will be just fine. I was a little bit of a pig, you know, but I drank a lot and I did a lot of other things. And at one point I shared an apartment. Well, I say I shared an apartment. I was sleeping there. These other two guys were paying the rent. But one of them was a drug connection. The other one was a bartender. It was in some ways it was handy, but I'll never forget. The thing though that made me say it is that the people that I drank with thought that I did too much drugs, and the people that I did drugs with were shocked by my drinking. And so, you know, everybody thought that I was getting too loaded. And, you know, for me, all of it, even alcohol was never a beverage for me. It was always a drug delivery system, and I was always about getting smashed. I didn't, you know, it wasn't, what does the big book say about joyous conviviality? You know, that was secondary for me. The main thing for me was that I really needed to change the way I felt dramatically. And I did that for a long time, but it started, and there was a time when everything was really good. You know, I mean, our big book says, and whenever I, this is the first 164 pages of the big book, the guy that I love in Dallas had leather bound for me. Whenever I say it says, I'm always talking about our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love that book. I got to tell you a quick story. When I was in treatment, there was a guy in there that we were in this detox center. I mean, and we had people. I looked pretty good compared to the guys I went to treatment with. I was a high bottom drunk there because I had a change of clothes. But and I'm getting ahead of myself, because but I got. got to tell you the story. This guy, I had 28 migraine headaches in a 30-day treatment plan. I wasn't sleeping very good. I was up walking the halls every day. And there was this, in the lobby of the where we, I went to treatment in the community area, they had this big case with a set of World Book encyclopedias in it. You know, back before the internet, that was a big deal to have, you know, encyclopedias and everything. And they had this big World Atlas. There was a slot in the back of the case that the World Atlas was in, and then the encyclopedias were on the shelves. And, you know, no big deal. It's just something out there. Well, I'm walking the halls one night, and there's a guy that come right off the street. He's crazy as a road lizard. I mean, I remember we had goulash that night, and he said, I don't eat health food, you know, I can't eat anything. They said, when was the last time you ate? And he said, 4 days ago. And he ate two skillets of goulash. So but he's sitting there at the table, and he's flipping through that World Atlas. It's about 1:30 in the morning, and I got a headache. I'm walking the halls, and he's going, man, this is really cool. And I was like, well, good. I'm glad you're digging it, you know. And I found out later, like after he was gone, that he couldn't sleep. You know, he was kicking, and he'd gone into the office. He said, I can't sleep. You got anything I can read? And John Burney had said, if you want to read something, why don't you go read the Big Book? And he was reading the biggest book we had, you know. So whenever we talk about the Big Book, we're this is what we're talking about, you know. I mean, so I have visions of this guy getting off back in the bar stool going, I went to AA, you know. I read their damn Big Book. It didn't do anything for me, you know. But I can tell you where Afghanistan is now. You know, what I was saying is that our book says that we are men and women who drink primarily because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And, you know, I don't think any of us drank because we were trying to tear ourselves down. I loved what alcohol did for me. And at the time that I first tried it, and for many, many times after that, it was just right. And as far as I know, it might have kept me from blowing my brains out, because I had a spiritual malady that I didn't even know about. You know, it's funny, I still sometimes struggle with the term spiritual malady, but almost everybody, and you hear a lot of people in the program talking about that hole, and to me, that's that spiritual malady that I came in here with. And I tried stuffing a lot of stuff in that hole, you know, before and after I came into this fellowship. But it worked real well for a long time, and then it just kind of quit working. And, you know, being the smart guy that I am, when it quit working, I just quit, you know, like 12 years later, and it just shut it down, you know. It was those 12 years that my family remembers the most. It really started getting sloppy, and I started doing stuff. Some of my outside issues required a little more money than a six-pack cost, and I started running a deficit, you might say. And I used to love the pawn shops. I loved to pawn stuff. The problem with that was I didn't own anything. And so I was always having to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that creates hard feelings, you know, with the people that you know. But what I would do was I'd go in my parents' house and I'd pawn a shotgun or a deer rifle. I didn't have to go in and take like the TV out of the living room, you know, where they'd notice like right away. There was stuff, you know, on the periphery that you could, and you could pawn for like, you had like 3 months to get everything out. And then I'd pull some big scam and get everything out, and then I could go, well, that all worked pretty well, but like most of my plans, the wheels came off after a while. And one time I came out of a 5-day blackout, a 5-day don't remember nothing blackout. I had pulled a little scam that netted $1,600, and that was enough to get everything out. And I came out of this blackout on the side of the bed upstairs at my parents' house, and I had $8 in my pocket, and I still had this wad of pawn tickets. Dark day, you know, I mean, just, you know, it's like, you know those mornings where you wake up and just go, oh, no, you know, because I, you know, I had it all together, and then I just, you know what happens. And so I would have to go to my dad, and my dad was a hardworking guy, good guy, you know, and I'd have to go to my dad and go, "Dad, you know, if we act now, I can get you a good deal on all your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's going to be strictly retail, you know." It's funny, you know, I tell that story, but I have to be careful when I tell that story because emotion is liable to just boil up out of me. I never intended to do that to my dad, so damn it, I didn't see it coming. But I like to tell that story like it's a joke so that doesn't happen, because I didn't like doing that to my dad. And we'd have to go around and to get everything out of the pawn shops. And, you know, everybody in here has probably made those promises, you know, where I'd say, "Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again." And the problem with it was Dallas, this was all in Dallas. And Dallas is a big town, and they got pawn shops and dealers spread out all over town. So it wasn't like, "Come on, Dad, we got to go to this pawn shop." It's like, "Okay, we need to do Garland Road. There's three shops on Garland Road. Then we need to go to East Grand. And then there's a couple on Harry Hines where I left a couple of things. And then Buckner Boulevard. And then we'll need to go out into Oak Cliff because I left some stuff out there." So it was all day in the car with that shame, you know, that just all over you. And I would be promising my dad that I'll never do this again. And if I was lying to him, I didn't know I was lying, because it felt like I meant it with everything that I had. But what would happen was whenever we'd get everything out, he'd give it a couple of days, and I'd hit his house like a cat burglar. And you know, my dad did that three times with me, where we went and got all my stuff. My dad eventually wound up in Al-Anon, but and I got a good story about that I'll get to later. But you know, the funny thing about it was this whole time I was about to go to treatment. You know, I mean, it had started getting sloppy, and I'd met a guy that was the maintenance man in my apartment that had told me about this treatment thing. And he kept coming in. He'd come in, and we were taking bong hits, getting ready for school every morning. And he would come in with us and talk to us about treatment. You know, I don't know why I thought we gave a damn about hearing about it, but, you know, he kept talking about this treatment. He never talked about detox. He never really told me what it was. But he said, you know, you need to... Well, he did give me one piece of bad advice. He did say, "Before you go, you might want to go pull a really good drunk, because they're going to make you not want to drink anymore." And I was like, "I'm on it." So that drunk, that last drunk took 9 months. And for that entire 9 months, I was about to go to treatment. I don't know if anybody else, you know, has experienced that, but, you know, Next week is a good time to go to treatment. You know, probably Monday or Tuesday, you know, I'm going to go to treatment. And then sometimes it would get really bad, and I'm going to go tomorrow. You know, I'll go. By God, I'll go tomorrow. We even had a couple. This sounds like BS, but we had a couple of Charlies about to go to treatment parties. You know, where you know, we would get our stuff together, and you know, because Charlie's about to go to treatment. But the problem was, today was never the day to go to treatment. You know, and when tomorrow, and I'll go tomorrow, but when tomorrow would get here, it would always be today, and today was never the day. It was like, maybe tomorrow. But, you know, well, so finally, I had to go, and I ran out. I got to the point where nobody I knew would let me spend the night in their house. I didn't know anybody that would loan me $3. I was just out of stuff, and it just was really sloppy. And there's some criminal charges floating around and stuff like that. So, you know, it started really looking sloppy. And I got to tell you about these pajamas. I didn't know what treatment was going to be like, but I had it pictured somewhere between the hospital and the jail. And I thought it was going to be more like a hospital. And so I went with my, I like stolen credit cards too, and I took the last stolen credit card I had, and I went and bought a pair of these purple Christian Dior pajamas and slippers and a matching robe. It's really kind of burgundy, you know, I mean, it wasn't... It wasn't tacky. A friend of mine, Mark Benno, said that that's Mogan David Red, is that color. But I needed those pajamas because I thought, you know, if you're in the hospital, you spend a lot of time in the bed. And I had this picture of treatment that I was going to lay up on the bed, and they were going to come in and treat me a little bit every day. You know, just treat you a little in the morning, treat you a little in the afternoon. And I didn't know why it was going to take 30 days. But you know, I had the room in my schedule for it. So I went. And you know, the last thing that happened was one night I ran into a car leaving a bar in a blackout. I'd had 5 Long Island teas, and I wrecked this car, but I'm still rolling, so I kept driving. And you know, I jumped out of the car, and for some reason my shoes were off, and I grabbed my shoes, and it was one of those nights where you can only see about that big, and I'm running back through the trees, and the cops were already looking at this car, and I remember thinking, good God, they got here fast. And so I ran to the bar, and like any good drunk, I reported the car stolen. And the next day they called me and they said, you need to take a lie detector test before you can pick your car up. And I said, well, why is that? They said it was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, you've got to be kidding. And he said, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I thought to myself, that explains how they got there so fast. But there's a friend of mine that talks about our lives being saved and changed by seconds and inches. And sometimes I like to think about what would have happened if those two cops had been standing behind that car writing a parking ticket. You know, I'd be talking at a jail meeting still tonight, you know, 20 years later. So things could have gone a lot worse than they did. I checked into treatment, and some good stuff happened there. This is Christmas time of 83, and I'll never forget, you know, we're learning a lot of stuff, but it was Christmas time, and on Christmas Day, they put out this beautiful spread, turkey and dressing. Now, I'm a big boy now, but I was 292 then, so I was a good 40, 45 pounds heavier then than I am now, and I was real interested in this Christmas dinner, and I get this big plate of food, and we sit down in this big room, and right when we're about to eat, the door swings open, and in comes a group of people from one of the local churches, and they're going to come in and sing to us. Come sing to these poor heathen drunks on you know, Christmas Day. And I thought, oh, good. And so I can't start my meal. And I'm sitting there, and this woman, I see her, and she's going around, and she's talking to this guy, and she's talking to this guy, and she's talking to this guy, and she gets over to me. And I usually tell this story when I get to the point where I'm talking about that what AA started on, and what started Alcoholics Anonymous, and what AA is still based on, is one drunk talking to another one. That's the beauty of this program. Is that I can't hear the message from a counselor or a psychiatrist or a PO or my mother or the lawyer, the judges, all the people that want to talk to us. But when you get one drunk talking to another one, we know whether we know each other real soon. This woman comes up to me and she says, are you a client here? And I said, yes, I am. She goes, I know exactly what you're going through. And I thought, really? She said, I was once addicted to caffeine. And I was like, oh, ain't that a bitch, you know. Did you ever pawn your mother's sterling to get a can of Folgers, you know? I mean, she was trying to identify, but it just wasn't quite there, you know. So that's why I like to talk about, you know, the beauty of one drunk. It started with Bill talking to Bob, and it's still, you know, what works best is one drunk talking to another one. You know, I got out of that treatment center, and I I did the first few steps while I was in treatment, but then I just tried to stay sober off of the fellowship. I got heavily involved in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to AA meetings, I went to AA barbecues, I worked with AA co-workers, I had AA roommates, I dated AA girls. It was just AA fellowship all the time, and I loved the fellowship. Don't get me wrong when I say this. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we have a lot of fellowship over at my house. We had, you know, 25 people for breakfast this morning, and probably another 25 last night. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I can tell you is the fellowship will keep you sober right up to the point that you get loaded. It will not fix the spiritual malady that we come in here with, you know. And I can't go to enough meetings to fix what's wrong with me. And what will eventually happen, the book says there will come a time when we'll have no mental defense against the first drink. And what happens for me is I've got a window of time. It's the only thing, the way I read the book, the only thing that's going to keep me from that point where I have no mental defense against the first drink is a spiritual experience. The book says that we have a physical allergy and then a mental obsession. So I can't drink, but I got a brain that is eventually going to tell me it's a good idea. And that was my problem when I got here, because I would always eventually drink again. My brain would eventually say, it's a good idea. It's not going to be like it was last time. And really, if you think about it, last time wasn't that bad. I mean, for God's sake, you might have been a little hasty going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that squirrel cage starts going. And at 10 months sober, I was crazier than I've ever been. I had an evening where I was afraid to sleep in my house with my guns in it. And I'm not a suicidal guy. I'm more likely to be homicidal than suicidal. And, you know, I'd never had any, and even that night it was a vague feeling, but I knew something was bad wrong with me. And this was 10 months sober. It wasn't too long after that that I took another run at it. And, you know, I like to talk about that first period of sobriety, because what happened was, during that time of sobriety, my life got a lot better. You know, when I was spending all that time in the fellowship, and I think I got enough relief from the meetings to keep me going for that 10 months. You know, I'd get nutty and I'd go to a meeting, and I'd get nutty and I'd go to a meeting. But I don't think it'll give us that spiritual awakening that the program talks about, the real life-changing stuff that this program offers. And you know, what happened, though, when I went out on that slip, we could talk about euphoric recall in here, about how, in my mind, if I am contemplating going back to getting loaded, it is a wonderful world out there. You know, I mean, it's like I've always got a pocket full of cash, and I've got a sweet car to drive, and the connection's always home, and he's always in pocket, and you know, it's just a beautiful world. And then, you know, when I went back to using, I remember just how ugly it was. You know, I mean, that there's so much ugliness that I had just fallen out of my brain. You know, I mean, that self-esteem where you got to put on sunglasses to go into 7-Eleven to buy a pack of cigarettes. You know, I mean, that's what I came in here with. So, you know, I like to think about it when I think about how wonderful it is, you know, for me to, or what I'm missing out on drinking. My sponsor one time, I was down on 6th Street, and I saw all these people, and they were having fun, you know, and I mean, like those people on the Coors Light commercial. God almighty, Coors Light looks fun, doesn't it? But my sponsor said, you're picking people that don't drink like you do to envy. You know, if you're gonna miss drinking, you need to go down there and pick out the guy that they, you know, that they're putting in the back seat of the car and going, watch your head. And say, God dang, I'm missing out on all of that. You know, I mean, you know. But I come back into the program, and that whole first time, I had really felt like, even though my life was a lot better, it was like right back here was drugs and alcohol, and it was still there for me. I knew my life was better sober, but I really felt like if I hit a point where it wasn't better sober, that it was still there for me. And March 22nd of 1985 was at that time, one of the saddest days of my life, because that was the day that it became evident that it wasn't there for me anymore, that Charlie Parker cannot successfully use drugs or alcohol in any fashion. You know, it's always going to get worse, never going to get better. And so now I'm back in this program because it's the only thing, it's my only shot, you know. And I had a new level of interest in this fellowship, and I really, you know, you hear all those, the stick with winners and you can't lose, and I really started hanging around people. I feel like I was blessed with people that were serious about the recovery program the way it's lined out in the book. And I love those people. I still love them today. I'm still drawn to people that you know, you're not going to hurt my feelings if you call me a big book thumper. I love this book, and I don't care whether, as long as you read it, you can thump it all you want, you know. But I started getting around people, and it's really funny. I met my sponsor, I did the first three steps with him. We did the third step on our knees together, and we really got a thorough understanding of what that hopeless condition of mind and body was that it's talking about in the first step. That idea that I can't drink and I can't not drink. And it wasn't until I really understood how hopeless that condition is that the higher power thing really started being interesting to me. The steps kind of roll like that. As long as I can do it, I don't know why I'd be interested in the higher power. You know, it's just stand out of the way and let me take care of business. But once I'm really convinced that I can't drink and I can't not drink, then it's like, you got something for me? I mean, and they go, yeah, well, there's this higher power thing. And you know, then it starts looking interesting. And once I'm convinced that that will work, it's a pretty easy deal to say, you know, let's get down on our knees and do the third step prayer together. So I'm right about there, but I'm still kind of stalling. My sponsor didn't give me that clear directions on the fourth step, and I didn't, you know, I went out to California to see my sister, and she lived in a hotel at the time. Her husband was the general manager, so we could get dry cleaning done for free. The point of all that is that I went to this young people's meeting in San Anselmo, about 200 people there, about half of them were pretty, and I'm starched and tight, and you know, I'd lost a bunch of weight, and I was not thinking about spiritual growth, you know. And I go in this meeting, and there's all these people there, and I go up to this girl after the meeting. Her name was Barbara, and I go up to her, and I said, do any of y'all go out for coffee or anything after the meeting? And she goes, yeah, a lot of us go to this JoJo's over here. And I thought, okay, well, I'd like to join you. So we, after the meeting, it was a great meeting. There was rock stars there. And, you know, the thing I'll never forget is this one huge rock star had her hand up for half the meeting, and they didn't call on her. And I thought, that's just what I get, you know. We go to the, and when we get in this coffee shop, she says, why don't you and I sit over here at the counter instead of over there with everybody else? And I thought, well, all right. And so we're sitting there, and she had introduced herself to me as Barbara, but I found out later that everybody knew her as Big Book Barbie. And I did not get what I was thinking about that. We sit down at that counter, and Big Book Barbie starts talking about, do you believe you have a hopeless condition of mind and body? God puts people in my life, you know, at times like that. And it's, you know, when I look back on it, I see that my life was saved, you know, and stuff like that. Because I, you know, but Barbie's going, have you turned your life over to the care of God? Have you done a fourth step? And I said, no, why not? Well, when you know, and it's just peppering me with questions. And I was like, good God, man! And you know, she's like, have you done a fourth step? And I said, well, no, why not? And I said, well, you know, I'm gathering this data because, you know, the treatment center I went to had a form, and there's a form, and this form, and that form, and she goes, you ever thought about doing it out of the big book? And I was like, no, not really. I mean, because I had looked at that stuff in the book, and the Mr. Brown, and she's a nut, and, you know, she snubbed me, and I just wasn't getting it. And Barbie said to me that, she goes, you know, if you work the if you don't work the steps out of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't show somebody how to work the steps out of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do work the steps, let somebody show you how to work the steps exactly the way they're lined out in the Big Book. You don't have to run around and get all these little henhouse four-step guys. If somebody comes up and says, can you put me through the steps? You just get out your Big Book and you sit down with them and work the steps. And, you know, I am so glad that I didn't get laid that night, you know, because looking back in my life, I've never had my higher power just speak to me, you know, but I've had him put people in my life that channeled me in a direction of growth that I didn't even know that I needed to go in. And sometimes I look back on it, and sometimes I think what chokes me up is that I can look back on that moment, and I know that my ass was on the line. I didn't know it at the time. You know, in the Big Book, when we get to that third step, it says we stood at the turning point. But there's no road sign. There's no street light at the turning point. You know, I didn't realize that the one direction was this and the other direction was that. It's just, you know, the way things were going. And so I'm real grateful when I look back on that. I've got, you know, there's other stuff that happened. There was another time that talking about the fellowship, while we're doing all these steps and stuff, we were in a lot of fellowship. Katie and me and, you know, I mean, Dave Hamby, God Almighty, that was, you know, everybody was getting together, and we did a lot of stuff together, and it was a lot of fun. It doesn't take but one or two people to really change the fellowship. You know, you get a couple of people that are willing to organize stuff, you know, like this weenie deal, we'd say, all right, we're going to go tubing to Guadalupe today, or we're going to, you know, we just come up with stuff, and everybody'd gang up. You know, the Pacific group out in California, if they decide to go snow skiing, they're chartering two or three buses and filling them up, and, you know, when somebody comes into that group, they know they're a part of something, you know, and I love that fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love people coming, you know, from rock bottom, nothing, and all of a sudden, you know, they're part of a big deal. This day, we decided we're all going to go to Wet and Wild, and my sponsor was there, the thing I want to talk about is that, you know, you just never know when you're going to be able to teach somebody a little bit, and my sponsor and I were at this place called Wet and Wild, and we're at this one ride where it's this slide. They just drop straight down about 110 feet. It's a high-speed enema is all it is. But, you know, you walk up this circular staircase, and it's almost our turn, you know. And we're like third from going. And the tower's kind of moving in the wind a little bit. And it's loud. The wind is blowing in our ears and stuff. And my sponsor looks at me, and he goes, "You feel that right there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "That's fear." He says, "Identify that feeling. It's going to come up again for you." You know, and I was like, "What?" You know, so you know, you never know when we're going to get to carry the message. But you know, another time, I'm going along, and I've hit. I don't know about anybody else, but I've hit. In my sobriety, I've hit some real bottoms, you know, where, I mean, it seemed like when I would go hear AA speakers that they would talk about how bad it was when they were out there, and then I came through those doors, and it's been nothing but, you know, happy, joyous, and free ever since. But, you know, that has not been my experience. You know, my alcoholism has been stuck to my shoe, you know, for a lot of my sobriety, and I've had to learn to grow up in front of you guys and with you guys, y'all have seen my mistakes and my successes, one time I went up to Dallas. This is another one of those examples where this guy spoke, and he talked about a lot of significant problems in sobriety, not being able to work, not, you know, spending more money than he made, gambling, a lot of the stuff that I just love. I really had never talked to a speaker after the talk before, you know. And this was at the Lone Star Roundup. There's 3,000 people there, and he was from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I was from Austin, and so I... And after the meeting, there's this big line of people that want to talk to him, and I said, I'll forget it. You know, but I really, you know, I had this nagging feeling that I was supposed to talk to this guy. And I come back to Austin. I had a phone in my car back when that was a big deal, you know. And I mean, it was like a couple of grand for a phone back then. And in order to call information, then you had to call the area code and 555-1212. It wasn't all this nationwide with connection and all this. So I'm back in Austin. I'm thinking, I really need to talk to this guy. And his name was Bob Bazans. And I don't know the area code for St. Paul, Minnesota, you know, so I can't call information. And besides that, how do you spell Bazans? You know, I mean, it's like, it could be 11 different spellings, you know. So, but that's Monday, I'm thinking about that. And then Tuesday goes by, and I'm still trying to figure out. And I go to my regular Tuesday night Big Book study meeting that night up over at Northland, and they say, is anybody here from out of town or other groups? And this guy raised his hand. He goes, my name's Bill. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. So I thought, well, there you go. He'll at least know the area code. And, you know, there's a chance that he'll know somebody that knows Bob, and maybe, you know, we can hook. So when the meeting's over, I make a beeline for this guy, and I go, so you're from St. Paul? And he goes, yeah. And I said, you don't happen to know a guy named Bob Bazans, do you? And he goes, yeah, he's my dad. And I went, whoa. And he goes, I really got to go to the bathroom. And I said, I really got to sit down, you know. And that's just those things. When I talk about God not really showing up, you know, but really showing up at the same time, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, you know. Where, because Bob, I was getting a divorce at the time. I was 5 years sober, and I was really not doing good. And Bob sponsored me through that divorce with some pretty stiff advice. And I don't know, how many people went to the 60th anniversary? So y'all heard him talk. You've heard this story before. But he is a solid AA. And this is a guy that's 38 years sober, and he's still working on his sobriety and working on his recovery and working on living better. And, you know, and so, I mean, and I love that. I had times in my sobriety where I was less involved in AA, more involved in AA, and I went through a period where I was less involved in AA, and a lot of fear, a little dishonesty starts creeping in, you know, and I had a couple of things that I was doing at work. I don't know if this has ever happened to anybody else, but I had a couple of things I was doing at work, and it started getting in the way of my spiritual life. Because I would get down on my knees. I never ever wanted to be a phony in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this program, and I never wanted to say, like, you need to be doing this and that, you know, if I'm not doing it, you know. And what started happening for me was I would get down on my knees and ask for God's will in my life, but then I'd have to go, I'll do this deal over here, you know. I mean, you know, you just, I'll take care of this. Well, and then that one other thing, I'll take care of that. But you can have everything else. It started feeling real phony, and then what I wound up doing was I just quit getting on my knees because it just didn't feel right anymore. And I would rock along, and I was having to, and you know, it just, there was a period where I remember I got asked to talk someplace. I didn't really feel like I had a whole lot to say, you know, and people weren't asking me to sponsor them, and I don't know how they can tell, but you know, I'd go to meetings and I'd sit there, and people weren't coming up to me and saying, you know, can I talk to you about the steps and stuff? But I never thought about drinking. I was still going to AA meetings, and you couldn't tell a lot of times from the outside. But what happened for me was, and I was in a marriage. And it was a commuting marriage between here and New York City, and on the outside it all looked real good. We had, you know, a penthouse apartment in Manhattan and a beach house in the Hamptons, and it was all. But it was a lot of stuff there that wasn't right. And So one night, July 21st, we're flying from the Hamptons back into Manhattan. First time in my life I've ever chartered a plane. I knew people that flew to the Hamptons every weekend. We chartered a plane the first time, and we get up there, and the guy powers back on the engine, and I'm in the co-pilot seat. I put the headphones on, and I hear him say, "You're cleared to Gabreski," and he goes, "No, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I'm going to have to ditch. We can't make land. I'm going to have to ditch." And I'm going, "What? You know, the first time? You know, I mean..." and so we crashed in the water at night in the Hampton, on Eastern Long Island. And, you know, the typical injury in a plane crash is a fatality. And there were five of us on that plane, and everybody but my dog made it. And, you know, it's just miraculous. But I came out of that deal, and I don't know what happened, but it gave me a whole new look at everything. It was an eye-opening experience. I'll never forget being in the drugstore like the next day, and somebody going, "How you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm doing good." You know, it could be a whole lot worse. You know, but what happened as a result of that? You know, I wound up getting out of that marriage, and I didn't really know what was happening, but I'm back in Texas all the time, and I started, you know, recognizing that whole, I did the other thing that I was doing at work, the little dishonesty at work, I got rid of that. You know, it cost me about $30,000 a year, but we stopped doing that, and so now there's nothing blocking me from my higher power anymore, and I really, I don't think I understood how much I was missing out on trying to manage. You know that line in the book where it says, "Isn't he a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from this life if he only manages well?" And I was managing my ass off, and it was not going good. You know, so one day I call up the guy I work with here, John Henry, and I don't remember what we were going to talk about, but he says, "Why don't you come to my office tomorrow at 3:15, and we'll go down to the ranch and talk to the winos." And it seemed like a big pain in the ass to me. You know, it's like, why can't we just meet somewhere and talk about me? You know, and so we go down there, and I started sponsoring guys again. And, you know, what happened was, talking to these guys, you know, that are brand new, I started seeing how good things really were. And then people started asking me questions. And then, you know, so sometimes if I'm teaching, I learn it better than if I'm being taught it, you know. And I don't want to be this phony again. So if a guy says, "Will you put me through the steps?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'll give it." And you go home and you get down your big book and you go, it's like, "I'll get back with you tomorrow on how to do that step." And you go home and you're like, right, you know. So, you know, I've been in and out of the book the whole time. But the point of all that is that I really am just, have both feet in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous now, and it's the happiest time I've ever been in my life. I can't even tell you. I mean, how much I'm enjoying, you know, working with guys, working with the fellowship, you know, going, you know, and sponsoring guys has been the best thing, you know, that's ever happened. You know, that, and then I've kind of got this new network of big book thumpers that we're always talking on the phone, I just love talking about this program and what the book says about it, and, you know, what's your take on this and that, and we do a lot of calling, you know, and it's just great stuff. And the more I study this book, the more I keep getting deeper and understanding this. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of funny. I was telling Katie the other day, you know, it's got to be funny, these guys that I'm sponsoring, you know, that sometimes, you know, I'm 20 years sober, and I'm going, "Whoa, look at that," you know. I mean, you know, because every time I read the book, I see new stuff in it, you know, and I'll get a different understanding of something in there, and it's... Sometimes I wonder if they're going, you know, what the hell's he been doing for 20 years? I saw that the first time I looked at the page. But I keep seeing new stuff, and I keep learning, you know, a deeper understanding of this program, and I'm really into carrying the message to new guys these days. And if you haven't tried it, I recommend it. The thing I never really understood was, well, that clock says I'm late, and that one says I got 3 minutes, so I'm going to go by that one. The thing I never understood, though, was, you know, that if you've had this spiritual experience as a result of working the steps, the way that it doesn't matter whether I'm sober 3 months or 3 years or 30 years, I can carry this message to somebody else. So, you know, the most beautiful thing that's happened lately was I was a guy that I sponsored. I'm sitting there up at the club, and a guy comes in, and he's crazy, and he said, I need to, you know, talk to somebody about this program. And I said, you need to talk to somebody that has worked this program page by page out of this book. And I happen to know that this guy has done it because I did it with him. And then, you know, being able to have somebody that I sponsor work with a new guy is one of the coolest things I've ever seen, you know, because then you're saving two lives, you know, at the same time. And I have figured out that I can't have more than about 3 or 4 guys in the first 9 steps, or I just got to quit my job, you know. So it's good to be able to, you know, move it around. But I mean, I stayed drunker longer than I meant to tonight. But I guess, you know, that's the biggest thing I'd have to report. And I'm starting to have new understandings about a lot of stuff. You know, I used to, you know, see when a new guy would come in, we would give him our phone numbers and say, you know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days or something like that. But I forget what it's like to be that day one, that guy that's coming in that first day. And just being able to walk in the door and take a chair is a monumental effort. And to expect that guy to be able to pick out a spot, you know, they can't find the bathroom, you know. So the decision of who's going to be their sponsor, I think it's too big of a decision to be left up to a newcomer. You know? So when I see a new guy come in, if nobody else jumps on him, I'll take him. You know, and it's been amazing to see how that effect takes place. You know, one guy gets sober, he works with another guy. It's just, it's, you know, I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always been in love with it, but I just, the past few years have really been awesome. You know, and if all I could say, the short version I'd say would be, work the steps the way they are in the book so you can work with other guys and show them how to work the steps the way they are in the book. If you know, and what Big Book Barbie said to me that night was true. You know, you can't give it away if you don't have it. So there's plenty of people around that will show you. I wish I had more time to talk about how it is now, because life is really awesome. But on the 12th step, on page, you know, I was glad that Kim said that those were the 9th step promises that she read, because this book makes promises to me. If I do the actions that are laid out in this book, it makes promises to me of what's going to happen. And they're not just after the 9th step. They're all over the place. And the ones I'd like to close with tonight are the 12th step promises on page 100. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thank you for listening to me, and I'm glad to be here tonight. Thanks.